Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. I'm Jamie, as always, here with my co-host, John. What's up?
Co-host, eh?
Well, I think we're both co-hosts. It's not like host and co-host.
No, I just meant like sometimes you say friend and I know.
I mean, we'll get into it sometime.
Listen to Bless Their Hearts.
It's going to be Thursday. It's going to be a good time. We're still here. We're still together. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I want to give a big thanks to a review that came in over on Apple Podcasts. This comes from Monstrosity Baby.
That's
phenomenal.
If my mom had a vocabulary, that's how she would describe me at birth.
I came across you all when I was trying to check in on if there were any date updates on the Blake Cruz case. Think you guys did an awesome job on respectfully covering that story and getting it out there. I went to school with and worked with him, and he was an all-around amazing human. That same town also recently had a double murder-suicide that has left so many of us heartbroken and without answers. Maybe we will get lucky and you guys or someone is committed to spreading knowledge and sparking conversations. We'll cover it. It's even possible for it to be covered, if it's even possible for it to be covered.
Wow. That's a thank you so much. Monstrosity Baby, is that what
that Blake Cruz case was? Fairly early on, Patreon request that we actually had to do some, like, you talk to officers and we did some deep dive stuff.
Oh, was that the, so he was in Western Kentucky?
Yep.
And a missing person, and or no, was it a missing person or
no, it was he was murdered
but unsolved.
The investigation went nowhere despite opportunities to go somewhere. So yeah. That's an interesting case. I actually Googled that recently. It came to mind for some reason, and there have been no updates, unfortunately.
Yeah, his name is one that I'll always remember, but I get it confused with the case we did around the same time where a young man, like right around his age, was just driving down the road, heading home, and then never made it, and they never found him. So
Bryce LaPisa.
Yes, thank you. I always get those names mixed up.
Yeah, Monstrosity Baby. Thanks for the 5-star review. If you want to leave us one, it's a great way to recommend a case, and we will read it on the air.
Another way to get your recs in is to join us over on Patreon. It's almost the middle of April, and we will have a brand new Patreon exclusive episode ready for you all in a couple of weeks. So you can join anytime and get instant access to all of our old cases that we only upload for Patreon members. There's about 8 years worth of those. We release them every month. And you also get our regular content ad-free and early.
Yep, and we're very happy to do that. So if you're listening to this on Tuesday, you could have listened to it yesterday.
Yeah.
For just $3.
With no ads.
No ads. It's great. And today's story, I mean, it's a lot, John. It's a lot in a way that there are a lot of different things happening. It's an industry that I'm not particularly knowledgeable about. So
it's funny that we do have a mutual friend we haven't spoke to in years, but that was in the industry. So
yeah, we
and I loved watching this industry on TV.
A lot of learning. The industry is fishing, not like bass fishing. This is like
professional fishing,
like commercial fishing.
Yes, I was like, professional can be bass. Yeah, like feed families fishing and get paid for all your bounty.
Yeah, which is what they're doing. That's what today's about, and it's also a bit of a mystery, which we haven't done a lot of those in a while. So
yeah, this story is wild. Jamie, why don't you get the ball rolling?
We're gonna go up to Alaska. The Prince of Wales Island is on the southeast part of Alaska, near the capital, which is the city Juneau. It's the fourth largest island in the U.S., but it only has one town of any significance, and that's the town of Craig. Craig is about 220 miles from Juneau, and it can only be reached by boat or plane.
You can't get there from here.
I don't know a lot about Craig, but I'd really like to be somewhere where people can only reach me by boat or plane.
That actually sounds really
nice. It does, doesn't it? This is back in the 1980s. Only about 600 people lived in Craig. And the economy was primarily the commercial fishing industry, and it still is today. So that means a lot of things. That means a lot of people coming and going as they are picking up, dropping off different loads of fish as they are stopping to restock for things. So it's a very, if you just think of like a port city where lots of import export, that's kind of what Craig is, except only 600 people stay there all the time.
In 1982, the Colthurst family was part of that fishing community. Mark Colthurst owned a new vessel that was used to capture salmon in really large nets. His boat was called the Investor, and it was a 58-foot long boat with enough room to hold a large crew, and it cost approximately $850,000. Now, this is in the early 1980s. That would be, I mean, well over a couple million dollars
in today's money. Yeah, I think roughly a trillion billion.
Yeah. This is a really nice boat. 28-year-old Mark had been in the commercial fisherman industry nearly 12 years before, but the Investor was new to him. Everyone who knew Mark said that he was smart, he was hardworking, he was from a well-liked family, and he was a family man. He was so ambitious that people remember that he would tell everyone he had a plan to retire at age 50, and most people believed him. I mean, at 27 years old or 28 years old, he'd been working for 12 already and owned almost a $1 million boat. I would say the kid had some wit about him and definitely determination. His younger sister said that he was just an incredibly hard worker who always said he was going to retire by the time he was 50, and I never doubted it. He always had irons in the fire. He was making money.
He came into fishing, honestly. His dad owned some other vessels, and that's how he started. He started working for his dad, and the life of any commercial fisherman, I mean, the reality shows are interesting. Of course, you only see the dramatic moments of people almost dying and the deadliest catch and that kind of thing.
I love those shows, though.
But essentially, you're taking a small crew of people, living with them on a boat while you travel around in these dangerous waters trying to track fish. I'm sure it's much more scientific than when I just take my reeling rod and some night crawlers down to the pond. But it's really hard work, so you have to trust the people you're around, and you have to be intelligent about the weather you avoid, the areas you avoid. And he did that. By all accounts, he had a crew he was familiar with, he had worked before, and for the Investor, he hired that crew. 19-year-old Jerome Cowan, 19-year-old Dean Moon, 19-year-old Mike Stewart, and 18-year-old Chris Heyman. The boys were experienced. Again, I know they're in their late teens, but they're experienced in fishing, and he had worked with them on different boats before. We're not really sure if they wanted to go into this forever. A lot of times that's your job until you find your career or want to move on to something less dangerous. But because of what we're going to talk about, I mean, their lives, we would never find out what they really wanted to do. Dean had been a high school football star, had just graduated high school. Michael and Jerome were already in college and just working for the season. Mark had handpicked them because he had known them for a while. In the first week of September of 82, he was bringing in to the fishing season and checking in Craig. They had a good haul the week before. They were set for a big payday, about 77,000 pounds of salmon to be offloaded. Now, when you think of a fishing boat, I don't know that I've ever been on a boat that wasn't a cruise ship that could hold 77,000 pounds of salmon, but this one could. Mark sold the salmon for about $30,000, but the Fish and Wildlife Department had temporarily halted the fishing season. So Mark and his family had to just kind of stick around Craig for a few days until they could get out and go fishing again.
Just a nerd in me wanted to know what the annual income in 1982 was for an average American family, and it was around $23,000. So in 1 week, he made enough to do more than an average family's income. So I would say he was probably killing it.
We're in the wrong business.
Yeah. Mark's family was based in Blaine, Washington. He was married to 28-year-old Irene, who was expecting their third child. They already had two other kiddos. There was 5-year-old Kimberly and 4-year-old John. So while in Craig, Mark was celebrating his upcoming birthday alongside the other fishermen celebrating the end of the season. So the family arrived in Craig on the Investor on the morning of September 6th, 1982, and they struggled to find a place to dock since there were about 150 fishing boats in town. He tied off the boat next to the other boats that were called the Defiant and then the Decade. Those are great, like, boat names or horse names.
I don't know how much money you would make doing this, but I would like to just be a boat namer. That would be probably safer than fishing and just as much fun.
You have a boat, but does your boat have a name?
It's had several names. It really changes depending on what TV shows my kids are into. I mean, we're in the off season here in Kentucky right now. I'm sure to go to a new name when it gets warmer outside.
We need to get one like engraved or embossed on the side of it somehow.
We do. And right now we usually just throw a sticker on there with the name of the year.
Yeah. So the family and crew walked across the decks of two other boats to get to the dock, and the crew went ashore to make some phone calls and have some drinks. The family went out to one of the few restaurants in town to celebrate Mark's 28th birthday. By 10 p.m., the family was back aboard the Investor.
Yeah, and again, there were four crew members plus the family of four. So eight people on this boat. And tying up to those boats was a pretty common practice. This wasn't like, we don't normally do this. I mean, this was kind of par for the course when you got into a dock area that was already pretty busy. So this was, to them, a successful trip and was going to be a fun celebration.
Well, and it sounds like it was extra busy because the Fish and Wildlife had kind of shut down fishing, so everybody was going to dock.
Right.
So I would say that it definitely was not a great time because you're losing money when you're docked. But yeah, like you said, I think fishermen, while they are competition, they're also just like they're friendly.
Yeah, there's a lot of fish out there. A lot of fish in the sea, they say.
And it's a big sea.
It is. It really is. At around 6:30 in the morning on September 7th, one of the crew from the Decade said they saw the Investor drifting away. From inside the boat, he saw someone at the wheel of the Investor and waved to them. Now, this was an interesting departure from the other boats because normally, if even with my little pontoon boat, if I tie up to something, I have ropes on my boat that I tie to the whatever I'm tying to, the dock or whatever. When I'm done, I untie it from the dock and keep it on my boat. When the Investor is drifting away here, the Investor had untied the ropes from their vessel. So essentially, they're leaving their ropes attached to the Decade and not on their boat, which is an odd thing that a normal crewman would not do on a boat like this.
It's odd because it's insane. Anywhere you park a boat is going to be on water, and you have to have ropes to stay where you need to stay. So it almost speaks pretty loud as to what the intention is here. They don't have a way to stay anywhere, so it makes you wonder if they plan on coming back.
Yep. They're looking to get away, it seems like. They thought that it was Mark behind the wheel and just kind of waved and let it go. But when describing the situation later, they remembered that the engine wasn't actually running. So it seemed like it was not only trying to drift away, but to do so quietly. At about 6:45, the captain of the Decade was standing on the deck when he saw the ship silently floating away. At this point, there was a man on the deck of the Investor who he described as a stocky with light brown hair wearing a red and black plaid jacket. At 7:30, another crew member of the Decade saw the Investor in the distance near the Fish Egg Island just across the channel. As the fog started to lift and they were able to see more and more of the Investor, they noticed that the boat was on fire. So immediately, a crew from another boat called the Casino, again, love these boat names, but the crew of the Casino raced toward the Investor to see if there was anything they could do to help either A, put the fire out, B, save people on it. What could they do to help? Because obviously this is a horrible, dangerous situation for everybody on board the Investor.
Yeah, as they approached the Investor, they saw a man in the Investor's skiff passing them in the opposite direction. This is like a small boat, right?
Yeah.
It's like it's a lifeboat, but it's not one of the inflatable kind. Usually it actually looks like a small, tiny boat.
Right. And you can anchor and then take the small boat into the dock or over to the shore for some reason. Like every fishing boat has a skiff or two attached.
The man was young, thin, wearing a baseball cap, and was described as having a pockmarked face. He told the men that he was going to find help and told people the same when he got to shore. Now, the casino crew didn't have any firefighting equipment, but soon they were joined by the Alaska State Troopers and local police. So the boat continued to burn all day until the U.S. Coast Guard showed up with two water pumps. And once the deck was cleared, authorities boarded the boat, and they were horrified at what they saw. We're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we will talk about what was seen on that boat once they were able to jump on board.
It was pretty clear from the jump that the fire was set intentionally, and it was a huge blaze. First of all, I have trouble in my mind rectifying a fire burning on water. I realize that like oil fires can burn on water and all those types of things, but in my mind, you would think it would be easier to put a boat fire out than it actually was. But again, this is a really big boat, so it's not a simple point and shoot with a fire extinguisher, right?
Yeah, I mean, this was a huge vessel, I think. Might be easier to burn down the skiff than it would be this one. But yeah, it's counterintuitive to set something on fire on the water.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they did find remains of humans that were not alive. They first identified the bodies of Mark and Irene, and those are the bodies they were able to get the most information from. They had burnt up, but it was obvious based on their skulls that they had been shot in the head multiple times each. Workers continued to sift through the remains of the ship and found four more sets of remains. All of those were burned in such a way that the skulls were no longer intact. Eventually, three more were found in the form of blackened bone shards. They were able to identify a few of these from dental records. They identified 5-year-old Kimberly and 19-year-old Mike Stewart. A lot of these bodies didn't show really any signs of what led to their death aside from being burned. They found a jawbone that was identified as belonging to Jerome. And whether Chris and Dean died in the fire is still unknown. And the assumption is, and I don't even know how to think about this, the assumption is that 4-year-old John's remains were burned to a point where they couldn't even be found. They didn't find any bone fragments or identifying pieces that could have been identified to John. And I think this does a lot of things. For this even to be on the table, this tells you how hot that fire had to be. This isn't just something catches fire because you throw a cigarette and it's going to scald you. Like, this was an intense, intense heat to potentially completely disintegrate human remains. This is one of the worst unsolved homicides in Alaska's history, and obviously brutal because the assumption is that all four crew members and all four family members, and remember that Irene was pregnant, so 9 people were killed on that boat, even though they couldn't say for sure because they couldn't identify Dean, Chris, and John's remains directly.
It was later learned that whoever set the fire first attempted to sink the boat by opening all the seacocks and waiting for the boat to fill with water, hoping that it would just sink. They chose to move the boat out to where it was eventually anchored because that was an area deep enough for the boat to completely submerge. A theory emerged that everyone on the ship died late in the night on September 6th or early in the morning on September 7th. Physical evidence showed no one who had been identified died from smoke inhalation or burns, so they were murdered before the boat was set on fire. Authorities believe that the killer snuck onto the investor while the family was out for dinner. Most people believe the killer was an acquaintance or former crew member with Mark, but most people believe the killer knew someone on the investor.
And I think that's generally a safe assumption. They, this is a tight community, kind of everybody knows everybody. And usually if somebody has something against you, then they had some dealings with you before. So I think that's a good place to start in the least.
Yeah. I mean, we know that when they got onto shore, they had to cross over four different boats to get onto shore. So, yeah. Maybe they also saw those people leave the boat and thought, you know, this is an opportunity to,
right,
to do something. Who knows at this point? Allegedly, a fight broke out and the killer shot his victims with a .22 caliber pistol or rifle based on the bullets found in Mark and Irene's skulls. The killer then moved the investor away from the shore, motored back to town, acquired a can of gasoline, went back onto the investor, set it on fire, and then sped back to town and disappeared. They do believe that their suspect is the pockmarked man described by the casino crew members who saw them on the skiff.
And remember, there was allegedly another man seen that was stocky in a red and black plaid jacket. So that description doesn't match the pockmarked man, but could be the same person, I guess, if the descriptions.
And was that second man hidden somewhere in the skiff? I mean, they only saw one in the skiff, so.
This also tells you that it wasn't a really well thought out plan. If you're killing them and then having to go into town to get the gasoline, I don't think this is something you've been planning for months, because there's a lot of scrambling going on to cover it up.
Also, on a boat this size, there would be hundreds of gallons of gas on the boat.
Yeah. So were they just not smart enough to recognize that or how to get it?
So it's interesting, though. They might not have been too skilled or familiar with the boat, because all the gas would have been on the back of the boat. That could have just, I mean, that could have caused an explosion that, right, would have been catastrophic. But they set the fire on the front of the boat. So they didn't even attempt to use all the gas that was stored on the boat.
Yeah. So I think that tells you a lack of planning, potentially lack of familiarity. And I don't know. It's definitely not something that I think was well planned out.
You would think that if it was a former crew member, they would be familiar with boats.
Right.
Or they were let go because they were idiots.
Yeah. I mean, that may be the key right there, to know that this person was fired due to incompetence or something like that. The FBI got involved, but the more they learned, it just kind of led to more and more questions. Authorities had some physical evidence, but the fire was so powerful and hot that it destroyed almost anything that could be helpful on board the investor. They towed it away, and eventually it did sink 6 miles away from Craig. The crime scene at this point not only is destroyed by fire, but gone and underwater. And authorities were left with eyewitness accounts and circumstantial evidence to go on, and really nothing else at all. The only solid leads they have were from the witnesses who saw the man sailing away from the fire. People in town also claim to have seen a man buying a can of gas early on the morning of the 7th. Unfortunately, the description of that suspect fits almost every man you could find in Craig. I mean, a lot of these people, you're doing the same job, you're all working on boats, you're going to be similar size and build, not universally, but a lot of these guys look alike. And this description didn't set this man apart in really any way.
Within a few days, there was a $15,000 reward posted for information. That's 1982 money. I know that there are cases unsolved in this town that we live in where that is the reward amount. So Think about it. That's a lot of money for 1982. Whoever committed the murder had to get off Prince Wales Island somehow. And like we said before, you can only leave by boat or plane. The only other way back may have been to sneak away by boarding another fishing boat. Investigators conducted dozens of interviews with fishermen. 2 years later, in the summer of 1984, not only was your boy John being born, but they were narrowing their investigation to one man, despite not having very much physical evidence. The Alaska State Troopers received several phone tips suggesting that they should look into a man named John Peel, a former crew member under Mark on a boat called the Kit. Peel had never worked on the investor. He was living in Billingham, Washington with his wife and children, and have been working as a shipbuilder since the murders. Four witnesses identified Peel as the person that they had seen rowing from the burning Investor. So the person in the skiff, they're saying, is John Peel. Another witness said that Peel also was seen in town buying a 2.5-gallon jug of gasoline the morning of the fire. So that's several people who have identified Peel as being in town buying gas and as the person leaving the Investor on the skiff.
We don't know exactly when these interviews were conducted, but as we do know, eyewitness testimony is not as reliable as we once thought it was. So if they're doing these interviews a couple years later, I could definitely see some misidentification here. We don't know completely what Peel's identifiers were that people said. I mean, obviously the pockmarked face or the scarred face could have been the indicator there. So if they did the interviews closer to the time this happened and it just took them 2 years to kind of put it all together, I feel better about that than as if these eyewitnesses came forward after 2 years. John Peel was charged with murder 2 years after the Investor was set on fire and potentially 9 people were killed. He was arrested just a few days after that 2-year anniversary on September 10th, and he was moved to Ketchikan, Alaska to await trial. The trial wouldn't happen for another 2 years and started in November of 1986. The prosecution's case stated that Peel was in Craig on the night of the murder, he knew Mark Colthurst, and that he had failed multiple polygraph tests when questioned about this case. They told the jury that Peel had once dated Mark's sister, and that wasn't necessarily a very healthy relationship, a very rocky on again, off again. And we do find out that Mark had fired Peel from working on his vessel when they worked together on the kit, allegedly not for incompetence like we suggested earlier, but drug and alcohol abuse. It was also believed that Peel sold pot to a couple of Mark's crew members on the evening of the murders. And again, they would have been potentially great witnesses, but they were killed as well. Peel's defense attorney set out to show that the witnesses for the prosecution were unreliable and that their identification was not reliable either. This trial went on for 6 months, which makes it sound longer than it was. There were a lot of delays, but this did make it the longest running and most expensive trial in Alaska's history up until that time. There were nearly 150 witnesses, mostly from the prosecution, and the jury deliberated for 6 days, which is a really long deliberation. So everything about this process of trying to convict John Peel for these murders just drug out. And ultimately, the jury could not come to a verdict. They were deadlocked, so it was declared a mistrial.
In 1988, there was a second trial. This time, it was a 4-month trial with only 51 witnesses for the prosecution, and none were called for the defense. That's a third of the witnesses from the first trial. The jury deliberated for 3 days. This time, they came back with a not guilty verdict. In 1990, Peel would end up suing the state of Alaska for wrongful persecution. He and his attorneys had uncovered a memo from one of the investigators that said the case against Peel was purely circumstantial and the crime could not be solved without a confession. So Peel was suing for $117 million, ended up settling for $900,000. Detectives still believe that Peel is the one responsible. One of them, in fact, said that it's a pretty darn good investigation. They got the right guy. Just because someone is acquitted doesn't mean they're innocent. It just means there's not enough evidence to show guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, end quote. Peel gave an interview to People magazine in 2017 where he said, quote, somebody out there knows what happened. Somebody was responsible for this, and somebody out there knows what happened, but I'm not going to waste any more of my life on it. End quote.
So he's acquitted, meaning that, essentially the crime scene was completely destroyed. They got no physical evidence pointing to him, just a few eyewitnesses saying that he was around, potentially purchasing gasoline. And if that's what they have, I have a hard time getting to beyond reasonable doubt myself, John, if that's truly all they had. And it seems like it is. So I could see why this would end in a not guilty verdict, even if he did it.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree.
Can we also talk about the money? How are you going to ask for $117 million and settle for less than one? That seems like a...
I think you need a better attorney at that point.
Yeah.
I think you at least... I mean, if he is genuinely innocent and he spent, 6 years of his life in prison for this, or over 6 years, I mean, that's... A million is definitely the bare minimum.
Yeah, I don't know that that's a bad settlement. Maybe the problem was just asking for $117 million. Yeah. It's just
ask for five and settle for one and a half.
Right, and don't ask for $117 and just take what you can get. I don't
know where you'd come up with that number.
Sounds random. For years, Mark's sister Lori believed that Peel was guilty. He was the guy. But then she met with him at a local diner and asked him some questions. She wanted to meet face to face and for him to tell her that he's not the one that did it. And after that, she's not as convinced. She said, I don't know if he's actually the one who pulled the trigger, but I think he knows more than he's saying. No other suspects have ever been identified publicly, and no one has investigated the case any further since the acquittal. They say all the evidence they have now is underwater. There's nothing else they can do. And more than that, the authorities think they had the right guy. So they're not looking for another person that they would believe would be prosecuting somebody that didn't do it. They say the case officially is closed. Most people close to this case believe there are people who know who killed the people on The Investor. One man who grew up with Jerome and Dean reminded People magazine that the community never stopped thinking about these people and wanting them to have justice. This is his quote. The shock of losing everyone really tore up our town. They all had their whole lives in front of them, and they were just blown away. It's such a shame and tragic for no reason. The names of those killed on The Investor are read aloud every year at a ceremony called the Blessing of the Fleet in Blaine, where the Colthurst family lived at the time of this incident. They were honored along with the names of every other person lost at sea going back to the early 1980s. As the names are read, a bell is rung, and Lori is always there to place five flowers on a wreath that is cast out into the bay to remember her brother and his family and the justice that they never got.
Yeah, this is a tragic case, and it's all too familiar with, you know, we live in an area where there is a huge unsolved case that just looms in the air. I mean, everybody talks about it. Everybody feels like they know who did it, but it's very similar that, you know, even though people may assume they know, police don't have enough evidence to make any kind of an arrest or let alone a conviction. So it's haunting. It's one of those things that will never go away until it's solved.
And, you know, it's the case of Brooklyn Farthing. We've talked about it a lot, but just a couple of weeks ago, some remains were found in the area, and everybody jumped to the conclusion that it was Brooklyn because of that, because of how present it is at the forefront of everybody's mind. Turns out that was a male, not Brooklyn, but the community was hopeful because that looms over us in a lot of different ways. And this community certainly feels that way. I don't know. I don't know if the prosecution could have held out to get more evidence if they really thought that Peel was the guy to try to get that conviction to happen. I don't know if they were desperate and just felt like they had to put somebody on trial. I feel like that wasn't enough to convict him, but if you're authorities, I don't know what else you do.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in this case with the fire and then it's sinking, there's not a whole lot of ways to get more evidence. Of course, if this was, you know, nowadays, we might have clearer video footage of who was getting gas, who went aboard the other boats to cross over onto The Investor. But it was the early 1980s. That stuff was just like I don't know, that was so advanced. It was almost like a foreign thought, like
this, right,
that we'll never be able to get to what we have today.
Yeah, we're there. We could be there today. You're right. I don't have a boat big enough for security, but I'm sure they have the security features that most people have on their homes. So I would think there would be more evidence. Unfortunately, this is the rare case where I think we've covered a story that will never be solved. I don't know that we're going to get to this one because of the extreme lack of evidence, unless somebody either A, confesses or gets ratted out. But even with that, you're still just stuck with the testimony.
Yeah. If it's a confession and they want to clear their conscience, that's one thing. But if somebody rats at this point, it's really their word against somebody else's, and there's no evidence to verify either story.
Yeah.
So I think you may be right, unless someone has a change of heart and comes forward. I don't imagine that will be the case.
Right. Guys, we'd love to hear what you think. If you believe this can be solved, maybe you feel strongly that it was Peel that committed this crime, and we would love to hear about all of that. So we often are able to give our opinions, but we need other sounding boards. Not that we always agree, but would love to hear what other people think as well. So we appreciate you joining us for this case and hanging through us through this story of a family and others being murdered. It's pretty, it's horrific at best. So thanks for listening and love to hear your opinions.
Don't forget, if you need more True Crime Cast, you can always visit patreon.com, sign up for a monthly membership. For as little as $3, you get our regular episodes early and ad-free, and you get a bonus episode each and every month.
Can't wait to bring you more episodes in the future.
Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.